you've found the Diggin' Oak Island podcast, a podcaster's journey to discover the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. Well, Dave McBride, thank you so much for downloading and listening. If you've been listening to the podcast and enjoying it, then I would ask that you help out the show by leaving us a 5-star rating on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you might get your podcasts. Also, I invite you to join us on Twitter and Facebook. You can follow the show at Diggin' Oak Island. We only have one email to read today before we get to this week's television content. It's not really a question, but when I get to the end of it, you'll know why I'm reading it here on this podcast. It comes from our listener, Bernie. Bernie emailed us last week as well. And this week he writes, "I have a daughter that is in college. Oak Island has been a big deal between us for the past 7 years. It gives us a great reason to stay connected and speak with each other on a weekly basis. We actually FaceTime tonight," this is the night that the show is on, "so that we could watch the finale together. Once I discovered your podcast and shared it with her, it has given us a chance to stay in touch even more, and that means the world to me. So I can't thank you enough for what you are doing. If at all possible, could you please give a shout out to Ellie this week and tell her daddy loves her? If not, I understand. No big deal. Keep up the good work. I hope your family is safe and healthy. Thanks, Bernie." Well, my friend, I think I just gave that shout out for you. And that sentiment is really far better expressed coming in your own words than anything I could possibly ever say myself here in your stead. I guess I'll say this. For generations, the Oak Island treasure hunt has been a generational hunt, so to speak, truly a family affair. The chapels, the rest stalls, the Blankenships, these are all good examples of Oak Island becoming part of what brings a family together. Dave Blankenship has talked about this a lot over the years, how this treasure hunt was what brought him and his dad to a relationship that perhaps they didn't or maybe wouldn't have had before they came to Oak Island. I'm lucky. I've always had a wonderful relationship with my father, and honestly, we talk about Oak Island all the time. And in fact, take a look at the image I use for the podcast logo. That's a take on the island's representation in an official nautical Canadian nautical chart of Mahone Bay. My father is a licensed captain with access to strange things like nautical charts of sleepy Canadian North Atlantic harbors. Before I launched the show, Dad and I went on our own sort of mini search of sorts to find the perfect image to use for the logo. Without his help, I wouldn't have found this. Thanks, Dad. Oh, and thanks, Dad, for listening to the show, too. Anyway, Bernie and Ellie, thank you both so much for listening. I'm glad I can be even just a small part of your Oak Island experience. It really is an honor for me to hear that, really. To say the least, it's an honor. I wish you guys all the best, and I wish all my listeners the best during this difficult time. Now, speaking of listener emails, I want to put out a call to all my listeners for some help in an upcoming episode of this podcast. In a few minutes, we're going to talk about the season 7 finale. And with another season of The Curse of Oak Island just about in the books here, I want to know what you guys think. Season 7 chronicles something like, I think it's exactly the 225th summer of searching in one form or another for the answers to the mystery of Oak Island. I want you guys to tell me what you thought of this past season of the show. And you don't have to just limit yourselves to talking about just season 7. You know, like, what do you think of where the Laginas and their partners are in the context of their own search? Maybe you can try to, you know, maybe put this all into some more historical context with your thoughts, you know, on how this season fits into the entire 225 plus year history of the Dig. Basically, what I want to do here is put together a Season 7 summary episode that is mostly made up of what you guys think. You guys who are the listeners of the show, but more importantly, the fans of The Curse of Oak Island. I want to know what you think of what we just spent months and months watching. Send your thoughts to me. You can do so either via email at digginoakisland@gmail.com, or you can also go through Facebook or Twitter, whichever works for you. Both can be found by searching at Diggin' Oak Island. Now, before we look into the season finale, let me just talk for a second, maybe more than a second, about the Drilling Down special that aired just before the finale. If you haven't seen it, it's available on demand. Go back and watch it. It starred William Shatner, not Matty Blake, and it was called The Shakespeare Connection. We've been talking a lot on this podcast recently about this theory, this theory that the treasure on Oak Island is not a treasure of gold and silver, but in fact, the lost manuscripts of William Shakespeare. And we've also been talking a lot specifically about Petter Amundsen and his Cracking the Shakespeare Code documentary, or at least the documentary he's involved in. So being able to see a special on this particular subject really couldn't have come at a better time for us here on Digging Oak Island. Amundsen, if you can't recall, is the Norwegian organist who has become famous over the past few years for his theory connecting the idea that Francis Bacon was the actual true author of all of Shakespeare's works to the Oak Island mystery, believing proof of that theory's viability is buried on the island, specifically in the swamp. In fact, in the opening scene of this Drilling Down show, Shatner states that some believe the original Shakespeare manuscripts can be found at the bottom of the swamp. And when he says some, he is referring pretty much specifically to Amundsen. Amundsen believes the first folios also contain something of a star map, and that map places an X, so to speak, in the swamp. Now, I'm not going to bother trying to explain how he does that. It's very complicated. This show gave you a sort of the nickel version of the process he uses. Needless to say, it's incredibly complicated. In my mind, it's also incredibly convoluted. So if you want to learn more than just what the show is presenting here, I'm going to have to leave that for you to do on your own time. It's very difficult to explain here on a show. I spent many an hour reading through this theory over the years, and honestly, my brain still hasn't fully recovered from it. Now, like I said, we've talked a lot about this, but just as a short review here, Amundsen believes the clues to the validity of the theory can be found within the pages of the so-called First Folio. This is the original published collection of the Bard's plays, which was put together by two of Shakespeare's colleagues and contemporaries, the actors John Hemmings and Henry Condell. It was published in 1623. That's 7 years after Shakespeare's death, just to give you some context. And it is this book, the First Folio, which becomes the very backbone of Amundsen's theory. He believes the folio acts as a secret cipher, which he has decoded, and that cipher weaves an incredibly complicated and layered trail to discovering how Bacon, Francis Bacon, and his followers were indeed the true authors of Shakespeare's masterpieces, and that they buried proof of that in the swamp. Okay, let's back up a bit. Again, I'm sure you must be aware of all this, but if not, there's a few of you out there who don't know what this theory is. This theory, this whole idea that Shakespeare didn't write Shakespeare is essentially founded on the fact, and it is a fact, that we have very little, if anything, actually written in Shakespeare's own hand. Most specifically, we don't have any of the original manuscripts that he wrote, you know, while sitting at a desk with a candlelight writing out, King Lear or something like that. In this Drilling Down, we hear from a Dr. Katie Mayer, who is an archivist at the British National Archives. She says, quote, "We've got 6 documents with his signature, and those are all legal documents." Later, an English professor named Dr. Michael Delahoyd, I believe is how you pronounce it, says that when talking about Shakespeare's death and his handwritten will, which we do have, that, quote, "What struck me is not just that there are no books, but that there is not any type of furniture that would hold books." It's certainly weird when phrased in that manner. And you could see how this conspiracy theory might have started just from this small little bit of evidence. But I'm really not here to discuss the merits of the Shakespeare connection. Well, yes, I am, but not entirely. What I really want to do here is talk about Drilling Down, this specific episode. Like all such theories, the part that gets left out when presented in shows like this one is the simple fact that Shakespeare not writing his own works is only one possible explanation for why nothing written in his hand remains today in a museum somewhere. And it is certainly not the most logical explanation either, if you think about it. I mean, that's pretty obvious, right? I mean, when you think about this, it's pretty obvious that that's not the most logical explanation of why we don't have this. However, we, the viewers, are not presented with really any alternative possibilities in this show. No other potential reasons why this might be the case. So I guess that's where I come in. Now, I'm not here to tell you this theory isn't true. I have problems with it. But I want to take this time to just point out how these clues can often be presented to us in a way that makes them seem much more concrete than perhaps they truly are. A kind of, you know, more concrete evidence than they really, really are when you just dig down a tiny bit deeper and take a closer look at them. And I also hope that this means, by doing this, that when you hear these kinds of theories in the future, you might also just kind of dig a little bit deeper yourself before passing judgment. For instance, with regards to there being so few examples of Shakespeare's own handwriting, the great Oak Island researcher and author Darcy O'Connor points out that another reason this is weird is the fact that we do have original manuscripts from other writers who were Shakespeare's contemporaries, you know, who also wrote during his time. The idea is, why do we have those, but not Shakespeare's? But the thing is, yes, there are some authors from this time for whom we have their original manuscripts, but certainly not all of them. Does that mean Francis Bacon wrote other playwright stuff as well? This is a time period when paper records are often dodgy or even just missing. I mean, without doing even a second of research into actual possibilities, isn't there perhaps a better and more logical sounding explanation than just leaping to the conclusion that Shakespeare didn't write them? Maybe the guy wasn't sentimental at all about his own writing. Maybe he had really bad, you know, embarrassingly bad penmanship. Or perhaps during his writing process, he made tons of errors and lots of corrections and crossouts and stuff, and he didn't want people to read that. We know Shakespeare borrowed from many sources when creating his masterpieces. Maybe in his original writings, he referenced those sources, quoted them, and referenced his research into these sources. But when he presented the plays to the actors, he wanted to, you know, pass them off as completely original. I mean, I'm just spitballing here. I have no idea. Just like I said, there are a million potential reasons worth exploring, but you wouldn't know that from watching the show. You would think the only possibility is he must not have written them. Here's another. During the exploration of a possible secret code embedded within the writings of the First Folios, it's pointed out that the word bacon appears only twice in Shakespeare's plays. On both of those occasions, the word is incorrectly capitalized because Shakespeare is referring here to the delicious breakfast meat and not the Elizabethan-era philosopher. So why then is the word capitalized in both times? I mean, that seems like a strange grammatical mistake to make in such an important publication, especially twice. Thus, they're trying to lead us to believe that something strange must be afoot. But take a look at the rest of the First Folio for yourself. You can find it online for free. You can find like a scan of it online. It won't take you long to realize there are literally hundreds of words improperly capitalized throughout the entirety of the text. And if you don't want to sift through the folio for yourself, just freeze frame the show on one of the images while you're watching it, one of the images of the text, and you'll see exactly what I mean. You can point to one strangely worded, strangely capitalized words like school and things like that. There's just a few. Just on that, just in those few paragraphs alone that they show us. Here's another example of a weird bit of evidence presented. See if you can follow me here on this one. This is a tough one to explain, but I'll try to give it a shot here. We're told by the experts that Shakespeare's era was something of a police state, and other playwrights and poets were persecuted during the Elizabethan era for expressing political views that the crown didn't agree with. Similar views can also be found in Shakespeare's plays. These other authors were tortured, and one writer even had his hand chopped off as a result, apparently. So the question then comes, why did this not also happen to Shakespeare? How did he get away with it when these others didn't? This must be proof he wasn't actually the author. But hold on a second. We're not doubting the man William Shakespeare existed. We're only suggesting that the William Shakespeare of history that we know was nothing more than, something of a front man or a patsy for a cabal of other more educated people who are trying to remain anonymous. But Shakespeare the man was certainly in his lifetime credited with and known throughout London as being the author. Those who came to see the plays at the Globe knew Shakespeare and were aware that he was the author. So why exactly wouldn't the authorities in this police state have gone after him for these, you know, thoughts that the crown didn't like, these ideas that were against, the crown's way of doing things? Are we suggesting that everyone here knew the actual truth, that Shakespeare wasn't the real author, that this actor wasn't the guy who's to blame? Are we saying that all of Elizabeth's court and all of her officials were also in on the scheme, so therefore Shakespeare was just given a pass by everyone? Are we really concluding that these heretical ideas were also somehow okay with the Queen, as long as they were giving the credit for their authorship to this patsy and not to the people who really expressed them? I mean, it doesn't make any sense when you stop and really think about it. Now, there are a bunch more examples in this show of these pieces of evidence, in air quote, that just don't seem to hold up well under even just a little scrutiny. I won't name them all, but let me offer up just one more, if you don't mind. Amundsen believes the swamp contains the mercy point, a point on the ancient religious tree of life symbol that he's convinced is referenced within the text of the first folio. He says, quote, "On the last page of The Tempest, he," and he's referring to Shakespeare, "tells the audience to pierce mercy." But does he really? Here's the quote from Prospero's epilogue, which ends The Tempest. "Now I want spirits to enforce, art to enchant, and my ending is despair, unless I be relieved by prayer, which pierces so that it assaults mercy itself and frees all faults. As you from crimes would pardoned be, let your indulgence set me free." Now you tell me, is Shakespeare, or I guess Bacon for that matter, telling us here to pierce mercy? And this one little quote, which is really twisted and then restated to make some kind of point here that fits with the theory, is a good example of what bugs me so much about Amundsen's theory. Yes, the words pierce and mercy are indeed both on this page. But it really does take some creative acrobatics for anyone to get to a place where that means Shakespeare, quote, tells the audience to pierce mercy. Throughout his entire theory, Amundsen seems to make these huge leaps of faith, which we're all supposed to accept, and many of them are presented here on Drilling Down without any rebuttal or pushback at all. How can we as viewers be expected to pass honest judgment on the validity of a theory if we only get the view of the true believer? In the current Oak Island zeitgeist, we think of the Shakespeare connection as something that maybe even originated with Petter Amundsen. But it is in fact much older than maybe you might think, much older than the organist's work. In this Drilling Down episode, we are kind of led to believe that the connection between Shakespeare, Bacon, and the Oak Island swamp only started when Amundsen discovered this supposed star map hidden in the secret code within the text of the first folio. But the fact is, we've been debating this idea for decades now, the possibility of Francis Bacon or maybe his followers hiding the original Shakespeare manuscripts in a 200-foot hole in Nova Scotia. This idea goes back to well before even 1953, when a man named Thomas Leary wrote and released a booklet called The Oak Island Enigma, A History and Inquiry into the Origin of the Money Pit. This is the first time this quote-unquote Shakespeare connection theory was ever published. But Leary didn't invent the idea either. He became interested in it after talking with Gilbert Hedden, who by the 1950s, after years of researching Oak Island theories, was starting to focus his attention a bit on this Shakespeare connection. For the last 50-plus years, if you did some digging into the Bacon-wrote Shakespeare conspiracy theory, Oak Island would inevitably come up in your poking around, even well before Amundsen ever came into the picture. Therefore, it's hard for me not to think sometimes that by the time Amundsen came along and started searching through the first folio for clues, that he wasn't, if even only somewhat subconsciously, looking to find some kind of evidence within the book that would connect it all to Oak Island, connected to this decades-old theory we now call the Shakespeare connection. Listen. I think it's probably pretty obvious to everyone now that I have a bit of a problem with the Shakespeare theory of Oak Island. For one, even if one does accept Shakespeare didn't write Shakespeare, the fact still remains Francis Bacon is not by any means the only suspect in this conspiracy. Not by a long way, But like I said, I've been over this many, many times already, and I think I've gone far enough down the rabbit hole here. I'm sure I'm boring you guys already. If you want to learn more about my thoughts on the theory and how it came to be associated with Oak Island, take another listen to my podcast called Francis Bacon and the Oak Island Enigma, which I released back on October 24th of 2019. I go over especially this Leary booklet a lot and really do touch on sort of my general thoughts on the Shakespeare connection. Now, before we take a break, let me also take a second to point out something that I wanted to just mention here. About midway through this Drilling Down special, they show footage from 2013 of Season 1, Episode 4. In this episode, Petter Amundsen is joined by Rick and Marty Lagina as they're dragging giant pieces of plywood through a pumped-out swamp. But it's pouring rain, so it's still a very thick, very difficult to move around, and very wet swamp. They're here looking in the spot where Amundsen is convinced he will find this Mercy Point, the place where the treasure vault should be or where something would be buried. He probes down with this long metal bar, and Marty remarks at one point as he's hitting something that it sounds like whatever he hit is possibly hollow. Amundsen calls it, quote, some kind of floor with small stones on top of it. And that's the last we see of this. I mention this because I was stunned they even showed this scene, and even more stunned that they did so while also not mentioning how this area Amundsen is probing in this scene from Season 1 was completely drained and excavated just this season. If the maps are correct that they give us, and I'll post images on our Facebook page of the graphics that they show of the Tree of Life and also of this paved area so that you can do a side-by-side comparison for yourself. But if the maps are correct, we now know what this supposed Mercy Point was. It's what we now call the paved area. Whatever Amundsen was hitting with that probe, it was certainly not a treasure vault or a treasure chest or what have you. It was a lot of rocks. So can we now conclude that Petter Amundsen was wrong? I mean, am I missing something here? From watching this now, this episode, now 6 years later, it would certainly seem that he was. You know, that this... Doesn't this mean that his theory's been disproven, at least the part regarding how it relates to Oak Island? I have to ask, why are we doing this special if not to point out how this incredibly expensive and time-consuming work done by the Oak Island team just this season basically accomplished the task of disproving this very controversial and very debated, often debated and talked about theory? Listen, crossing a theory off the list is a great accomplishment for anyone in Oak Island. And didn't they do that this season? Folks, am I missing something here? Email me or message me and tell me what you think on this. Is this theory of the Mercy Point alive and well, or have we already looked at the Mercy Point? It seems like we did. Now, after I just rattled off a bunch of criticisms about this special, can I just say here that I really did enjoy this show. I like William Shatner, and I like the way he handles this. The William Shakespeare / Francis Bacon theory, well, maybe not my favorite, is a fascinating subject. And despite the fact that they didn't present the other side here, so to speak, the show did a good job of presenting this theory. Oftentimes, Prometheus leans on stock footage to make these specials, but not so much here. There really was a lot of great new footage and a bunch of new experts to hear from, as well as the return of, you know, some great familiar faces like D'Arcy O'Connor and Mark Finnan, and of course, you know, Petter Amundsen, who is an interesting character in this Oak Island play. Also, as the Drilling Down special was concluding, I couldn't help but wonder, why did they just air an hour-long special on the Shakespeare Oak Island connection right before the start of the season finale? The show often plants these little historical seeds in our heads right before something is discovered. Was there some reason the viewers sort of needed a little Baconian Shakespeare refresher before watching the finale? I mean, I couldn't have been the only one thinking along these lines. But as it would turn out, the answer was no. It's time to look at the Season 7 finale, Episode 23 of The Curse of Oak Island, called Timeline. As if perhaps we didn't know this was the last episode of the season, it begins with Rick Lagina and Craig Tester walking around the Money Pit area, telling us that it's November and that the quote-unquote window is closing on the season. There's even some snow on the ground to help make the point. This is it, folks. It's find something now or wait out the winter and hope to return next spring. And honestly, looking at this footage from just a few months ago, it's hard not to think how everyone on the island who's thinking about the future and the possible future of the dig is just blissfully unaware of the global upheaval that's only just a few short weeks away. There's a moment of great hope. The workers from Rock Equipment operating the oscillator are 100% certain they have hit a sizable void, remarking that around 200 feet down, it's like there is, quote, no dirt at all, end quote. But like so many moments of hope over the centuries on Oak Island, this one, too, is quickly dashed. Soon the hammer grab is bringing up loose gravel and dirt, something they shouldn't be finding at that depth. It appears they are getting our own backfill, as somebody says, meaning that there's very good reason to believe the ground they're driving through is about to get very unstable. Vanessa Lucido, who's the leading the work here, is, you know, and done a lot of drilling and has been in these situations before, is obviously concerned for their safety moving forward. She clearly thinks the potential for a collapse or a cave-in here is, you know, rather high. As a result, the work is halted. In the end, RF1 comes up empty, like so many before it. I think it's Craig Tester who remarks how RF1, quote, didn't get to the bottom 10 feet, end quote. Another failed exploration on Oak Island. How many times over the years has a searcher said something like, if we could only have gotten just a few feet further? Attention then turns to the swamp. I told you a few weeks back how Dr. Ian Spooner, the swamp doctor from Acadia University, had found a piece of wood lodged within the rocks just under the paved area in the swamp. They were tree branches, and it was his expert opinion that by dating these branches, we essentially would be finding the date of when this paved area was created. Well, Spooner's back on the island, and he has his dates. From what I can gather from the quick images, he says around 1200, but it looks like he had two branches carbon dated. One, the results say 1022 to 1218 AD, and the other says 1036 to 1217. Now, carbon dating is not very accurate. We're used to these dendrochronology things, which give you a single date. Carbon dating can't do that. You often get these big ranges within these results. But it still is important to point out that, you know, both of these results are very consistent with each other, which kind of lends some credibility to Spooner's theory. Also, if these branches were placed in the swamp or the paved area was created literally anywhere within these timelines, it's a fascinating find. Whether it's the 11th century or the 13th century, this is still very intriguing and still very puzzling data. But at the risk of sounding like a Debbie Downer again, I think it's important to point out that this new information is only dates. It only gives us the when and offers no clue on the who, what, or why. It's often the tendency of the show to and the cast as well to assume things on Oak Island can only have been done by Europeans, meaning this medieval dating, medieval in the European context, is evidence of perhaps the Knights Templar coming to the island sometime during that period. But is it really? I mean, honestly, are the Knights Templar really the only people who could have dug a few feet in this swamp and then placed a bunch of rocks down there? Let's face it. There is a lot that is fascinating about what they've uncovered in this season in the swamp. But none of it, in my mind, points definitively to something only Europeans could have done. None of what we have seen so far in the swamp eliminates the indigenous people as possible suspects here. I'm not saying these dates are not fascinating, and when taken within the context of the lead cross, it does add another piece of evidence for this medieval time frame. I guess I'm just still waiting for someone to tell me why this couldn't be a place where the Mi'kmaq tribe would, dig and mine for some clay that they would use for pottery or that kind of thing. Why does what they have found in the swamp this season lead anyone to the conclusion that the Knights Templar must have buried a treasure there? I agree. There are answers to be found in the swamp. It's no doubt mysterious. And it obviously has a complex history that has been, you know, lost to time to some degree. But at this point, that's really all we found out. The paved area and the dates associated with it just haven't pointed to much in the way of, you know, answers in my mind. Let me try and frame it a little differently. Last year, when the team unearthed massive wood structures in Smith's Cove, the wood that created those structures was dated to the mid-18th century. from before the discovery of the money pit. If nothing else, that date tells us that something big and probably clandestine was built and conducted on Oak Island, something that was obviously kept a secret or for some reason just lost to history, because it seems like a big project and done at a time when Canada was Canada, you know, when Europeans were here, when records were being kept, when memories should be, passed down through the generations. It's not much, but it's something, you know. Does the paved area offer even that much information? My feeling is that at this point it doesn't. It just tells us that something a very long time ago happened here, but we don't know who might have done it or why or what it was or anything like that. Just that it happened then. Hopefully there's a lot more to come over the over at the swamp in the next few years. But for now, we can only speculate. After only a few minutes, really less than half the episode, work for the 2019 season is essentially concluded. The team then sort of adjourns and spends the remainder of their episode at a meeting in the war room with the entire group for a debrief of sorts on the work they just finished and where they now are in this hunt. It's a fascinating discussion. Now, I know a lot of viewers just want more digging and want them to find treasure and all that, but I love scenes like this. The show can often really be lacking in sort of contextualizing all of this work, but they really do at least take a good swing at it here in this scene. Charles Barkhouse lays out on the table something of a timeline for us to see, placing many of the artifacts found on Oak Island by the team on this sort of long piece of paper that shows when these artifacts were dated to and how these dates kind of all relate to each other. It's a fascinating little exercise and an eye-opening one for sure. It appears what all of this labor has produced is evidence that something, I don't know what, happened on Oak Island anywhere between the 12th century and 1795, a period of almost 600 years. Doug Kroll really frames it well when he says, quote, "Look at the artifacts. There isn't a theorist out there that isn't going to be happy." It's a great line. He means no matter what your particular idea of who did what on Oak Island is and when you think they did it, you can find an artifact, some piece of evidence, just sitting on this timeline that fits rather nicely into your theory. So, for instance, if you think this was the work of pirates or maybe of Spanish explorers, you have the 1652 Spanish coin you can point to. If you think this was the Knights Templar, you have the lead cross, along with this new dating from the swamp. You get where I'm going here. Let me put it this way, a much more sobering way, I think. After 225 years of searching, 225 years of digging, theorizing and researching, after the loss of six lives and countless fortunes, we aren't really any closer to even narrowing the suspect list down than we were in 1795. Sure, maybe we've crossed one or two off the list. The crown jewels of Marie Antoinette is the first example that comes to my mind of something that's been sort of disproven over the years. But that's about it, really. 225 years of the hunt, and the timeline is still 600 years long. And this, folks, is what I love about Oak Island. 600 years of potential suspects. It's amazing. Now, before we call season 7 a failure, and I do understand that some fans are concluding that, and I understand why, the team kind of gives us a little glimmer of hope for the future of the operation. A few years back, Marty Lagina dropped a Canadian $2 coin, what they call a toonie up there, down a hole called H8. H8 was the small borehole that they dug in season 5, and then that later turned into the location of a much larger can-type shaft that you see that happened during season 6. It also caused, if you can recall, a partial cave-in around this can. In a scene that was a little clunky for sure and probably a bit staged as well, Gary Drayton pulls a toonie out of the spoils of this new RF1 hole, and Marty identifies it as the one he dropped down H8 3 years prior. What that means is this coin then went down the hole, and rather quickly, because they didn't find it when they did the spoils of the can in the next season, it rather quickly traveled horizontally or laterally about 10 feet. And according to geologist Terry Matheson, that shouldn't happen. That's a sign that there are possibly water currents moving around underground in the Money Pit area. So in the bigger picture, It means the possibility exists that literally everything down there has moved around. And who knows how far and in which direction? It's the best evidence that trying to pinpoint the money pit, the actual location of the money pit, might very well just be a fool's errand, since whatever was placed down there, you know, by the original depositors centuries ago has most likely traveled underground to some other unknown location. So put it another way, somewhere in the range of the last 150 years or so, the digging that's been done at the money pit can now, kind of in hindsight, be looked at really as hopeless all along. And now the team has to question whether the method they have used up to this point, this method of digging exploratory drill holes and then following that up with these larger cans driven into the ground, whether or not that method can really even be effective from this point forward. If everything has moved and dispersed around, then historical evidence and even the underground geological data used to pick the location for a new dig really isn't any help. It would all just sort of be guessing at this point. So what do they do next? Well, when thinking about the answer to that question, Marty says something that is sure to reverberate throughout the Oak Island fandom for months to come. He says, quote, "The next step in the money pit, if we really are considering a big dig, is not just millions, it's tens of millions," end quote. Now, seems like a good time for me to do my best Robert Clotworthy impression. A big dig? That's right, a big dig. And considering the size of the digs these guys have already done on the show, we must be talking about a really big dig. The show tells us for 10 years, though they haven't really discussed it much, but for 10 years the team has been kicking around the idea of this big dig, the idea of clearing out essentially a 100-foot-wide area of the money pit down to a depth of 250 feet, using a couple possible methods for achieving this goal, which they showed you on the show. Honestly, I can't tell you how many times I've seen an Oak Island fan on social media ask why something like this isn't being done or hasn't already been done here. Well, here's the answer. It is incredibly difficult and seemingly prohibitively expensive. And if you didn't notice, it can take up to 3 years to complete. Let that sink in for a second. 3 years. Imagine watching this project with no end for three seasons. You get where they're going here and why they maybe have tried other alternatives to find the answers to this mystery before turning to this big dig. But I have to say, it does appear at this point that the Laginas are already committed to this idea, at least to some degree. Or why even mention such a thing on the air? Marty also says the Toonie, quote, "argues for the big dig." And Rick then states that it might, quote, "ultimately be the only way to get to the bottom of what happened here on Oak Island." The question now seems to be, is it all worth it? I mentioned my father earlier in the podcast. The day after this finale aired, I called my dad and we talked about this idea of... whether or not it's worth it. Have centuries of searching in the money pit really produced enough evidence to justify spending tens of millions of dollars on this project? In the end, we came to the only real answer. It doesn't matter what we think. It only matters what Rick and Marty Lagina and Craig Tester think. It's a cop-out, I know, but it's true. Maybe there hasn't been enough evidence for us, but there is for them, and they're the people doing the search. But do I want to see a big dig? Yeah, sure I do. Do I think there's evidence there, you know, over the years to merit such a project? Well, I think Laird Niven summed up how I feel best. He said, quote, "If we look at the science and the archaeology, something happened. We have hard scientific evidence for that. Whether it involves treasure, I couldn't say. But something significant happened, and it seems to be worth pursuing. It's obviously worth pursuing." Okay, everybody, that's all for this week's Diggin' Oak Island podcast. Folks, next week, Tuesday, May 5th, I think it is, at 8 p.m., we're going to have another new drilling down special. This one is called Closer Than Ever or something like that. Here's the official description from the History Channel. Maddie Blake visits Oak Island in the dead of winter, only days before the coronavirus pandemic changes the world. And later, he connects with Marty, Rick, and Craig to learn about the safety of the team and plans for the future. So with that on the schedule here, my plan is to do a podcast next week discussing that episode of Drilling Down and maybe doing my own sort of wrap-up of Season 7 a bit. Then, like I mentioned before, what I really would love to do is to hear what you guys think, not just about Season 7, but also about the bigger picture and even the future of the hunt. If I get enough responses for all this, then I'll dedicate an entire show just to your comments and opinions sometime after next week. But seeing as we have this show coming up, this Drilling Down next week, and how important it is for the future, it's probably a good idea to wait until after that so we have a better idea of where we really are in all this. So please, please, please send your comments to me. You can do so via email at diggingoakisland@gmail.com. You can also send them via Facebook or Twitter. You can find the show on those sites by searching at Digging Oak Island. Don't forget, you can also help the show out by leaving us a 5-star rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you to everyone so far who has done that. I really do appreciate you taking the time to do that. So until we speak again, I'm Dave McBride. Thank you for listening to Digging Oak Island.